From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in introspective Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Lydia Simchich, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark McCroy. I, too, make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are being honest with your work and the critical eye. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start.
GDC.
Uh-huh.
Just bringing it up now, because maybe you should start thinking about it if you're planning on going. It's expensive, turns out. Who'd have thought?
Yes.
And I know, Mark, you have already been talking about going to GDC.
Yeah, so from where we're sitting, GDC last week announced its sort of how they're changing the event.
Yeah.
They're calling it the Festival of Gaming, mm-hmm. which I don't really know what that means.
Yeah.
But I think it's very much just a... they're putting their foot down and saying, like, things will be a little different this time. So one of the main things is that the event was broken up into, it was a 3-day conference, actually.
Yeah.
We always think of it as a week long, but it's really only a 3-day conference. The first 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, are the different disciplines all hold their own
workshops and stuff.
So for a lot of us indies, we think of that's where the indie talks are, but that's also where a lot of the other specialty tracks do. And then the last 3 days are more general.
Yeah.
And that was a sort of maybe it worked for some people. You could also get a pass for just one half or just the other half.
Yep.
Or just a certain track. They've simplified this. It's just 5 days and it's all put together now. The actual content is not going to be that different. It's just all going to be part of one event instead of one event, but pretending to be two events. So that's mm-hmm. kind of a clarification. But that's the kind of thing they're changing, is some of the sort of like kicking the dust off a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
That came with a new branding and all of this stuff that I feel they have yet to fully explain. Another area they're trying to focus on is more networking capabilities. One of the things that people go to GDC for is to network.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But also GDC itself has not been great for that purpose.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It just is that everyone's in one, you know, across two city blocks in one city at the same time. Mm-hmm. So people set up independent events. There are other organizations that hold networking things. Years ago, I talked about called Game Connect. I forget the name of it now, but another similarly very expensive to attend thing where people do B2B stuff and do pitches and all those sorts of things.
Yeah.
GDC is trying to reclaim a little bit of that and put it within the actual thing, which is good for them because honestly, that's the main value
they
get. And so, if they're going to charge people a lot of money, they should offer some real services in that capacity.
Yes, mm-hmm.
We'll see how well they do with that. But anyway, where you're sitting, listeners, is news is a couple weeks old. But if you're thinking about going, the sooner you can get your travel plans booked, the better, because things always get really expensive, mm-hmm. as is any kind of convention setting. It just, you know, if you want to be close enough that you don't have to take a taxi to every morning to get there, you're going to want to
act now. Mm-hmm. I already got my accommodations.
Because we go every year, we go most years under press badges.
Yes.
Which we actually didn't go last year.
Yeah.
Or rather earlier this year.
Mm-hmm.
That was for a number of reasons, which I think was the right choice for us as a group.
Yeah.
We all had a lot going on at the time.
Yep.
Yeah.
We haven't gotten our press badges yet. That registration isn't going to open up for another month for
okay.
us. But I got a pass already because I'm going to be speaking there.
Oh,
which exciting. Is a first for me. It's pretty cool. And I'll talk a little bit more about that when the schedule's announced and stuff like that. It's interesting. It's not that interesting, I'll say.
I'm just, every year I submit a bunch of talks.
Mm-hmm.
And this year they bit on one of them.
Okay.
Is it the naming one? Mm-hmm. I know you've been submitting the naming one for a while, and we have a great pitch for it.
I know. I'm never going to stop pitching that one. The idea of file conventions and stuff, which we talked about on the show recently.
Yeah.
That, I think, is the most valuable thing I could ever impart.
Yeah.
But no, they didn't bite on that one this year.
Dang.
Anyways.
Next year.
There's other things I might be doing there. Mm-hmm. So I'll talk more about all of that once that stuff is all settled, which might be in the next couple of weeks. So we'll see. So, not to tease anything, but my GDC plans are not fully put together yet.
Yeah.
I'll wait to detail.
When you have more, you'll give us more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I thought it would be good just mention it because if you're thinking about it, now's the time to start really thinking about it.
Yep, and I'm thinking about it, so you got to start thinking about it.
You want to do some networking?
I got
job interviews.
Got to do some smoozing and stuff. It's gonna be great. Uh huh.
I will say, as someone who's never gone to GDC looking for a job,
yeah.
I have very frequently in conversations with people, like, found myself in a situation where I realized that they're looking for people to hire.
Yeah.
And I was kind of wasting their time.
Oh, sure.
Because that's not what I was there for. And because I forget how that is, it's a huge recruitment week.
Right. Yeah.
So it's, you know, it's an insane amount of money for travel and accommodations.
Yeah.
And the ticket price just for that.
That's the main reason why I'm not looking forward to it.
Right. But I would say it is worth it.
Mm-hmm. I think it probably will be. But
yeah.
We'll
yeah.
see. I mean, hey, I'll probably have a job by then anyway, so I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, yeah.
I gotta manifest it.
Exactly right. And Lydia, you're interested in going. You have not been yet.
I have not been. I have been explicitly told never to go unless someone is paying for it.
Wow. Right. Well, we're getting you a press pass.
I know. So. That would be ideal.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I think we're more, I'm also interested in, I'm actually quite interested in trying to do some more, get some more pitch meetings.
Oh,
last
sure.
time I did this was in 2020, mm-hmm. 2019, forever ago, for Widget Satchel. I took a bunch of meetings, and that's how we got our Japanese publisher from those meetings. Mm. And I was not particularly good at booking them or doing them. Mm. So, like, the fact that I got some result out of that is very nice. But I feel like I've got a couple things that I might want to pitch. So I would need to spend some time to put together a pitch and booking. So I might be focusing on that come January, start to try to get all that put together. Now that I know that I'm definitely going.
Yeah.
I shouldn't just go just to do the talks and
you know,
Blippo Plus just came out, so there's a little bit of like a maybe like, you know, talking with folks about that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm actually to get some real value out of it, maybe I should be trying to make more opportunities.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Or I don't know, maybe I'll see who's recruiting. Like
sure, yeah.
That's I am sort of out of a job.
More opportunities.
But I don't imagine myself going to work for a studio.
Mm.
But like I don't know. If you're making a cool project and I'm interested, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a path for me. I have no idea.
I'm pretty sure that work with indies typically will do a thing outside of GDC, like in Palo Plaza.
That's
and
good to know.
That might be more like that might be the vibe where you go and like say, hey, what are y'all doing?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot. Everything is outside the event.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, we'll see how much that changes with their new direction.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Yeah. Well, I just came back from a conference.
Yes.
I love conferences, side note. Mm-hmm. I love going and meeting people and learning new things. It's a vibe. I really enjoy them.
I really like this because I'm happy that we've maintained our 2/3 love conference status here in the clubhouse.
Oh, good.
That's always been the case.
Yep. And it continues.
Steven has always been the grouch.
Yeah, that's true. That's
well, they are exhausting and you do need recovery and they are expensive, but I really do love going to them. I just came back from the conference for the American College of Chest Physicians.
Mm-hmm.
It was in Chicago this year. Last year it was in Boston. And I thought, man, that was for the escape room that I designed for chest last year. Man, it would be really fun because if I could just like sneak my way in, because I could go to my mom's house, take the commuter rail in, go in and just like hang out and help run the escape room. I was on my honeymoon at that time. Slightly different. But
yeah.
Started my honeymoon in Chicago and I'm back in Chicago. Actually was able to, they were able to bring me out and pay for a few days of my time, not the whole time, but a few days of time to help set up and do the first two days of running the escape room.
Yeah.
Cool.
So that was cool. I also got to see some friends at a really good time and then came back, recovered a bit. And yesterday I went to the Stardew Valley Symphony of Seasons concert with Ian.
Exciting.
Very cool.
Ian got these tickets so long ago, we actually can't remember for what holiday. We don't remember if it was like Christmas or anniversary or Valentine's Day. It was one of those.
Mm.
And so then suddenly when it was October, it's like, oh my gosh, we're going to go see Stardew Valley like this month.
Cool.
And it was really fun. I really enjoyed it. It was really, really cool to hear how the music translated into a small orchestra.
Yeah.
And it was just great. The vibe's immaculate.
Was this at Orchestra Hall?
No, it was at the Orpheum.
Oh, neat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Which is also our first time actually going to see a show at the Orpheum.
Yeah.
Which was really cool. It was a beautiful space.
Non-locals would be like, what are you talking about? But
yeah, I suppose. That's an interesting case because I went to a Zelda concert years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Zelda, a lot of music is orchestrated or built to feel orchestrated, mm-hmm. you know, if it's like an NES game. And so that easily translates. But I would imagine Stardew Valley doesn't really have that exact vibe. So it's like interesting to hear yeah. it expressed in a different way that way.
Yeah, and it was a little bit audio and visual, so they had yeah. a projection of some like actually hand-drawn animations or actual gameplay. And it really was both a travel through the seasons, but also across Stardew Valley. So there, one of my favorites was that they actually did all of the levels of the cave one after, like one bleeding into the other. And there was an illustration of like a stratigraphy of the cave levels. Mm. And it was beautiful.
Cool.
It was nice also because then if you didn't necessarily remember what it was or where this piece of music belonged, you had the visual. It's like, oh, this is... fall time, and this is what plays when you go here, or oh, this is the Wizard Tower theme.
Yeah, yeah,
that's very good. Yeah, yeah, especially for something that is the corpus of it is rather large, mm-hmm. and your experience of it isn't so like when you listen to a song, what you're doing is listening to that song. Mm-hmm. When you hear music in a video game, you're actually doing something else.
Yeah,
and so I think for people who are really obsessed, you know it back and forward. But I think for a lot of people, like. It kind of not washes over you, but it's part of the whole experience.
Yeah.
So when you have a thing like this, it's really neat that they were to frame it to mimic a little bit of that and guide your attention. Mm-hmm. That's very, very cool.
Yeah. I also, in between, I guess, loosely what each movement, the conductor would speak a little bit. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that was just on a personal note for him that was kind of nice is that he said he grew up in the Mississippi River Delta, and so like music was a big part of his life. Music conductor now, and banjo was a big part of his life. And this is the only time in his professional career that he had a banjo that he was conducting banjo in an orchestra.
Wow!
And that was really cool.
Yeah,
that was really really cool.
Awesome. That sounds like a great time.
Dale and I also saw a concert recently. It's a totally different story from yours, which is that we got the tickets last minute. And it was not something we were planning to do or building up towards, which is we saw Paul McCartney. He of Beatles fame.
Mm-hmm.
He's on a tour, which has been, he's been on this world tour for like years, mm-hmm. like 2022. Just constantly touring. And, he's getting up there, and for older artists, you're always like, is this the last time we have a chance to see?
Yeah.
And so that's a little bit of a macabre kind of vibe to it. But, I'm a huge Beatles fan.
Yeah.
So is Dale. But we never really were that interested because it's like, I'm not going to spend $1,000 to see like some Beatles songs and a lot of Wings songs. Like,
yeah, yeah.
I don't like Wings that much. And so a little of a cynical attitude, but, he played at the big US Bank Stadium, mm-hmm. the giant, NFL arena here, mm-hmm. in Minneapolis, which is like a walk from our apartment. And the tickets were like $40. So,
oh, dang.
Because
yeah.
the venue is so big. There's yeah. just so many tickets. Mm-hmm. And so near the end of the thing, it just started to be, I don't know if they lowered the price or something, but we got, not even totally nosebleed, but like perfectly reasonable seats for very little money. So it just felt like a day and a half before the concert.
Yeah.
I learned about this, that there was these cheap tickets available. And it's like, well, I would really kick myself if I didn't go see a Beatle. But I didn't spend like money I wouldn't miss to walk through my neighborhood to go see a Beatle. Like, it's
it
just
practically landed on your lap.
Yeah, the more I thought about it. So we went, and I'd never been to this stadium before because I'm not a sports fan.
Yeah.
It's been around for a couple of years, but it dominates the skyline from my apartment window. Mm. And I was like, you know what? It's an interesting building. I'm actually also curious to see this cool building and see what it's like. Because we have another stadium in town, that a baseball field
right.
that's also relatively new.
Which is near my apartment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As an urbanist, I'm skeptical of private public partnerships to build arenas.
Sure.
I don't think it boosts the economy enough. I think it's like these things should just be built down in the suburbs where there's plenty of parking lot space.
That's okay.
And they should be built entirely with private money. Mm. Minneapolis, we're actually one of the very few major metros where all of our major sports arenas are within our major cities.
Mm.
And all but one are in downtowns.
Yeah.
It's actually really uncommon for that to be the case. And that always kind of bothered me a little bit. But Target Field, where the Twins play baseball, is a fantastic space.
Oh, lovely.
Like when I finally went there, and I was like, okay, I still hate that too much public money went to this.
Sure.
Blah, blah, blah. And, you could have built a lot of housing instead. But it's a wonderful space. Mm-hmm. And I think they did a really good job sort of designing it, but also like building it sustainably and making it part of the local culture. And the architecture is great. So I was like, well, I should see this place too. I should finally go check it out. Feel totally different. It's a terrible building.
They also, that building keeps killing birds. And every year people are like, hey, can we put something on the windows that will not disturb like the look of it, but we'll make sure that birds stop running into it. And every year they're like, no.
Yeah. Mm. So it's a hideous, it's not a bad looking building. It's just too big. Inside, it's hideous and utilitarian. Yeah. It has no aesthetics or design. It just feels very like we built the cheapest version of this that would
it's
make
a place
sense.
That you can go to.
It's a place you can go and watch football. I was really disappointed.
Yeah.
Wow. And but actually worse than that is it sounds awful.
Oh no.
It's the worst sounding room in the city.
Oh, okay.
Which kind of bummed me out a little bit. Now that said, you play Helter Skelter as loud as you possibly can, which he did.
Okay.
You still can enjoy it.
All right.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
I'd heard rumors like, oh, it's a bad place to see a concert. I'm like, yeah. Well, all arenas are pretty bad to see a concert. Yeah. The acoustics aren't great,
right.
But it was really, really bad.
Oh, yeah. Man. That sucks.
So interesting.
But I don't regret going at all. It was cheap. It's, you know, I saw a Beatle. It was amazing.
Yeah.
Nice. I've never thought about stadiums and stuff like that because, one, I'm not a big sports person. I mean, I enjoy going to see live sports, but it's not a thing I think about or do.
Sure.
Really. And also because, like, my reference point is Fenway Park.
Sure.
And so, like, Fenway Park and the other places in Boston, I think I've seen a hockey game and a basketball game.
Yeah.
That to me is obvious. And so Twin Stadium feels very normal to me.
Sure.
Yeah. And I've never really thought that would. I don't know, because I've never really lived anywhere else where there would be a city where there would be a sports team. And so I'm like, oh, wow, that actually is a good point, huh? You usually don't see them downtown, do you?
Yeah, just the really old ballparks.
Yeah.
So a lot on the East Coast. And then just a couple of other places around will have that. And Minneapolis is one of them, sort of interestingly. And yeah, outdoor stadiums are great places to see concerts. Because you can really engineer those very well.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have all the bouncing services.
Right.
But here in the Midwest,
we're not going to do that.
We don't have a lot of outdoor stadiums.
Yeah.
Our ballpark is.
That's
but,
true.
And they do summer concert series there sometimes.
Yeah. So my topic kind of comes off of my experience at Chicago a little bit. First off, really, really enjoy my time. I'm really hope that they are willing to spend the money on me coming back and helping. Because one, I think I was actually able to help a fair bit. Having more than one person who knows everything about a puzzle flow and how things are supposed to be makes then training other people and making things go so much easier.
For sure.
Because then it's not all on you.
Yeah.
And it's not on you while you're also context switching.
Yeah.
So I really hope that they find it's worth the cost to bring me over if they'll have me.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I went for the escape room that I think listeners have heard me go, that, because it was a bit of a crunch.
Yeah.
I emphasis, really enjoyed my time there.
Mm-hmm.
Loved the conference. It was cool. And I kind of walked away from a lot of it not really knowing how to feel about the project in general, about how it turned out, especially considering I think some of it is also because last year's was so good.
Sure.
It was a really good game and it was such a fun project.
Yeah.
I really, really loved working. I mean, that's why I wanted so badly to work on this again.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I was really, really excited when they said, like, hey, are you still free to do this? I was like, hell yeah, I'm going to work with Jest again and make an escape room. This is great. But it was not as successful in many ways. And I found just trying to articulate it and process it. I've been fine. I in general, have been having trouble figuring out what to think about it or how to feel about it. I love the postmortem process. I really like doing postmortems and retrospectives and things.
Yeah.
And we can talk about, like, logistically, what does that look like at another time?
Yeah.
Because this part is a lot more emotional in terms of when you work on something and you need to kind of look at how it lands and think about it critically, but also. So that was because ideally when you have something, you learn from it, right?
Yeah.
We keep making, we learn from our mistakes. That is something that fundamentally I believe in and I preach and I try to practice, but it is also very hard. How do you do that honestly by being able to honestly recognize what didn't work, what really was bad, but also not discredit what did go well,
right?
And without making excuses because of circumstance. Like, you want to be able to give yourself grace and believe wholeheartedly that you did the best you can with what you had in the moment.
Yeah.
I personally really hate, and this has, like, you know, come baggage I have from history major stuff, where it's like, that kind of speculative, well, why didn't you do this? Why didn't you do that? And it's like, well, there's a lot of reasons. It may have been, quite logically, probably was the thing to do at the time.
Right. Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
It's the thing. It seemed like the thing to do. Very Bud Grant. How do you recognize and acknowledge that you did the best you could and it wasn't good?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Without excuses, without discrediting. And then kind of how do you go from there? Mm-hmm. I mean, especially coming off of such a good one, right?
Yeah. That's the question I want to ask you about this, because I think there's a very natural instinct when something doesn't land the way you think it, which is that you get sort of internally very defensive. You're like, well, people didn't understand it, or there's all these external reasons why it was such a game. And those are defense mechanisms.
Yes.
It sounds like you have the sort of luxury of it sounds like that's not really happening, that you can push past that a little bit, because you're sort of, seems like you're facing it pretty bluntly. But my question is, do you think the reason for that is just your general experience, or is it because you have this other thing to compare it to that, as you've described, went so well, and we've detailed here on the program in a past episode, it's just so obvious what the delta was.
Yeah.
Did that make it easier for you to sort of like very, without having to worry about like fully mapping it out in your mind, it just was very clear? Or is this just something that you would expect, if this was a totally different project that similarly didn't land the way you thought, would you be feeling the way you feel now?
I think in terms of like, I'm not being at the moment as defensive as, because I have felt defensive internally earlier.
Okay. Oh, okay.
So I can feel myself doing that. And that's something I've tried really hard as a person to deal with, I think, and mostly as a person, but that has had a good benefit to my work of trying to recognize when I want to be defensive.
Yeah.
And when I have that impulse and say, hey, this is a response, and let's kind of recognize it and move past it. Mm-hmm. I definitely don't like the feeling of like I messed up, and there are certain, like, there are definitely darlings that I should have killed, or like, there's that feeling of like, I did the best I could. I really was at a disadvantage. I want, like, the emotional intent of that is somewhat based in fact.
Sure.
Yeah.
I want to honor that by recognizing, you know, hey, I did the best I could with the circumstances without making it an excuse, because that's when it gets defensive. I've had that. I still kind of feel that. I have had the distance and the thought of it and a little bit more, so I'm able to talk about it a bit more clearly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When it comes to like the having the A to B delta, I think that definitely, that can help.
Yeah.
Because it is, I mean, it is my one data point. There are some other things that happened that was different from last year, but then also was like fundamentally unusual for this year, that I got from other people, or people that's like, were kind of vibe checking like, hey, are we getting things a little later than we normally do?
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't know. I've been doing this for 1 year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which gives credence to some of the things, the points where it's like, hey, this was out of our control and was not good. But, and I think that, you know, looking at, I think having the A to B is helpful, because that is a little bit of a good reference in terms of more of the subtleties, the things that maybe you would only notice if you had like play tested something of like, okay, well, why did they get this puzzle? And kind of intuitively, air quotes, know what to do with this, and know, like, get a number and then know what to do with it.
Yeah.
Or find a thing and then know where to put it. Why is it so much more obvious this in this scenario than it was in this scenario?
Yeah.
So I think A to B can help with that, because then it's a little less of the like deciphering what is quote unquote intuitive, what is quote unquote common sense, because common sense is not common unless it's learned.
Yeah.
And we rely on that, you know, intuitive language, visually or otherwise, with puzzles, with escape rooms, with games.
For
like,
sure.
I mean, you know, affordances or whatever the actual more accurate term is kind of what I'm leaning into. Mm-hmm. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think so. I guess the not knowing any of the details about the production process.
Yeah.
The when you said like, oh, it didn't go as well this time, I know a lot about the previous time because we talked about it on the show.
Yeah.
And so, but I don't know enough about You detail some of the content for us.
Yes. I can give a little bit of an outline of kind of what do I mean and like what the sitch was.
Well, I guess, yes, I would like that. But yes. I think the point I want to make is that not knowing any of those details, so like not knowing where you might judge yourself to have screwed up or something, mm-hmm. it seems like because it's a similar type of project, it's an escape room, it's mm-hmm. an installation, you're helping run it at a conference, all those things are very similar. The actual content is different,
mm-hmm.
And it's the kind of scenario, and we talked about this when in the episode we talked about your first one, where it's very difficult to play test, and there are things you don't know till you run it.
Yeah.
So just in my mind, from knowing nothing, I feel that there's plenty of reasons for you to not worry about how well it went, if that makes sense. Not to be dismissive of like of the analysis process. So I'm kind of wondering if a lot of this maybe is due to the fact that this is the second time doing it, maybe you haven't had in your career so far, maybe this is the first time that it's sort of felt like a setback. Maybe that is new. Maybe it's a new experience for you because you just had banger after banger up to now.
I don't know if I would say banger after banger.
Yeah.
I think that this is new to me because this, as well as Category Quest, mm-hmm. are the first times that I've been able, or okay, Category Quest was the first time that I've released a thing and then is live.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
being iterated on continuously because it is part of a live product.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is the first time that I've actually been able to see any of my work in the environment where it's being used, either because either it never saw the light of day, or because it was like what I made was proprietary, or you know, it was just had to go on. It very much it gets sent off because also I work with a lot of client work.
Right.
So it is new. Seeing it as a thing that is being responded to is extremely new. Mm-hmm. Like I've always kind of known, like, oh man, if I ever did an entertainment game that got like launched, I don't know how I would handle it because mm-hmm. it's something I don't really know. Yeah. That is definitely part of it.
Okay.
It was a different disease process. So last year we targeted chronic uncontrolled eosinophilic asthma, which might mean something to you, maybe not. But and it had one patient. This year it was COPD,
mm-hmm.
and we originally had four patients, and then they cut one, which was actually the one that was the easiest to cut and just keep narratively and just kind of make her not content, but make her like part of the puzzle.
Sure.
So it was fine. That was ideal for that one to get cut, but it was still three patients and it was a lot.
Yeah.
And you mean scenarios.
Yes, yeah. Because a lot of the puzzling, ideally, at the content that we get is you have this patient with these things and this data, and you need to figure out this thing answer this question about them,
yeah.
about this case, essentially. The other thing is we didn't get that information in full until like 3 weeks before it was due.
Right.
And fundamentally, that was the thing that was out of our control and that I really wish that it had been different because the way that I design is I have all of the impact objectives and the content in front of me, and I do more research, and then I look at the pile of stuff and I find the games in there.
Yeah.
I find the patterns. And the thing that was that is also really difficult with puzzles mm-hmm. is in order for the puzzle to be fair and just, you need to work from the answer
mm-hmm.
because then you're going to be able to make the puzzle off of that. So that way it only will point to the answer, and that when you know the answer, you realize why it points there.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it is not a puzzle, it's a gotcha.
So that was an extra challenge because of the situation in which you created the project.
Yes, that was
and the... So you're trying to separate out the responsibility,
yeah,
ultimately for the how it landed.
Yeah.
Because it sounds like fairly clearly a lot of it is... well, I guess phrase a different way. How surprised were you? Because I remember you talking about how like the timeline was shorter, mm-hmm. the information didn't come till late, mm-hmm. so it felt like you had to do a lot of design without content,
mm-hmm.
which is usually not great for learning games.
No.
I know Ellen really gave us really taught us about that kind of structure.
Fundamentally not good.
And so you probably should have expected it to, even with whatever Herculean effort, you would not have been unreasonable to expect it to not be as successful.
Yes.
So how much of a surprise was it that it landed the way it did?
I think it not landing where I wanted it maybe wasn't surprising. I think it mm-hmm. was what other things were not land, what other smaller aspects of it that didn't land, that was the thing that's surprising.
Okay.
And I think some of it, that's where it's like is this related to the, you know, situation that we needed in versus is this bad design?
Can you separate those things, or it's all part of one?
Yeah,
big reason.
Yeah. Like, for example, I will fully admit, I feel comfortable saying this. Like, the darling I should have killed is that one of the things I was really excited about is I found a actual like history of how telephone numbers changed between the advent of the telephone and modern day Chicago, like local to Chicago. I had telephone exchanges. I found a White Pages as a primary source. So it's like, oh my gosh, I can actually like add mid-20s phone numbers here. But that's a darling I should have killed, because no one looks at three letters and four numbers and thinks telephone.
Okay,
and we found that even on something that looks like a Rolodex with a telephone icon, they still didn't know that it was a telephone.
Yeah, okay.
Right, right. Which, as you were designing, probably, well, this is a context that should provide all this thing. Mm-hmm. But as a player, especially in escape room, you kind of expect random numbers to be in random places.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you probably weren't on the lookout to make those connections.
Yeah, COPD was the disease. 1920s Chicago was the setting that we were
getting. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just, and we said in Prohibition Chicago.
Yeah.
Context.
Yeah, so from what I'm kind of understanding, it sounds like, yeah, there were a lot of things that were wrong that weren't under your control.
Yeah.
And it does definitely seem like you're separating that kind of stuff. But it's like there's a lot of other things that maybe didn't go the way that you expected that is causing conflicting feelings about how it all went down.
I think what it is a little bit is like these are things where the puzzle and game design failed that disadvantaged the player, not because there was too much content, not because the content was hard.
Yeah.
There were some things I did really learn that I didn't expect to learn that I think was very productive.
Okay.
But for example of like bad design, we had a desk map puzzle, and we had where the idea was that you had like the multiple choice questions about these patients and you had those on a piece of a square with a corner cut off. And the idea is you're supposed to put them on the desk mat and then use a bottle, a red bottle, so it looks like faux whiskey. Yeah. And you put it on the middle, and it's like one of those reveal, like it's a red film that reveals a path, and you're supposed to connect the correct answer to a four-digit number that you put into the desk locks to then open up more information about the patient to then continue the puzzle.
Yeah.
People did not know what to do with those multiple choice. They did not realize that it had to go somewhere.
Okay.
Even if it was an unusual shape of paper. What we ended up doing to try and make it easier after day one is we traced out the lines from where it would be on the page to the numbers, like leaving a void. So it's like, hey, something should go here. And also I took washi tape and I actually made a kind of like I don't know, like those chalk lines for dead people. I basically did that for where you have to put the pieces to try and make a like, oh, something's meant to fill this void.
Yeah.
And that didn't work at all.
Oh, dang.
Not in the slightest. And, you know, some of it I think is like, it's not like it was on the desk, and as soon as they get three files, they're going to throw it onto the desk and start investigating.
Yeah.
Some of it's because it's like there was no other reinforcement, like color coding. Mm-hmm. I mean, some of it was it's just like, how would you put two and two together? That is one of those things where fundamentally they didn't know what to do, and I always had to tell them. I can't figure out where I failed in the process of not catching that or not thinking that through all the way and reinforcing and establishing there's multiple things that are pointing to this being connected to something else.
Sure, and it sounds like it's difficult, even if you're able to lay out the facts as what this is what happened and this is tried to solve and it didn't work out. And even if you are able to recognize what didn't and didn't work, it's kind of difficult. It sounds like it's difficult to specifically process it sounds like almost the emotional you messed up part.
It feels very much
the facts of it. Yeah.
It feels very much when like people say, how could I have not noticed, or how could I have missed this? Or like, you know, is it a failing because of me of a designer, or a failing because of the circumstance?
Sure.
You know, I can't tell what happened.
Yeah.
On the interesting as far as postmodem side that I didn't expect, but was really good to learn. So we have a type 2 inflammation diagram. That essentially shows like when an irritant comes into your lungs, how it goes through like cellularly and like chemically to then result in an exacerbation or an asthma attack.
Okay.
Apparently that diagram is really freaking hard.
Yeah.
Even for healthcare professionals. And it's because, and I didn't know this, it's because that level of detail in a diagram is not something most healthcare professionals learn. That's something very specialized to pulmonology.
Ah.
And so it's something where it's like they might have actually, and I actually heard someone say, oh, I just learned this, like at the conference.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So because it is like such a like a niche thing.
Yeah.
And we had that as a as like one of the beginning puzzles.
Sure. I see.
Last year we had that as the end puzzle.
Yeah, okay.
And so that ended up being like it was a diagram, so it was really obvious. Like, oh, you have to we have to put the right things in the right spot. So so it was obvious what they had to do mechanically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We had the same thing. Like they and I was talking to them. They understood how they needed to fill the puzzle out. So that was good. Visual language worked out in that case. But like literally, they were just like, "Is this where this goes?"
Yeah.
Actually, you know, and I actually had to help them a fair bit.
Yeah.
So I've learned like, oh, that's a better late game puzzle. That's not a good let's start the game with
sure,
this puzzle.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
So that was very productive.
Okay.
But yeah, the sense of like all the other little things where it's like, oh my gosh, like they're looking. This happened to have a number on it, and it was just flavor, but they're reading into the numbers too much.
Yeah.
Or like this one doesn't have like multiple things showing that this belongs here, or there's no clear indication of like, oh, I have this now, what do I do with it?
Yeah.
Those were things that were so I did such a good job last year. And I don't know why I didn't do that this year. And I think that's where it's and I the fact that I can't tell why it I what happened.
Okay. So I think there's a lot of this really sounds like playtest feedback, at least the life cycle of playtest feedback, where you show someone a thing and you're watching them do it, right?
Yeah,
you weren't playtesting, but the scenario is similar.
And I, to be fair, like Frank, I did not have that opportunity last year because I wasn't there last year.
Oh yeah,
this was a unique opportunity for me to see it be playtested live.
Right, that's true.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So I knew I was going to get more info than I normally do. But to put it in perspective, most people finished the game, like completed the puzzle room within the 20-minute time limit last year. I think only one team did when I was there.
Yeah.
Mm, okay.
It really was, I mean.
So you could be a hex on the whole thing. Well, let's not rule that out.
Yeah.
But
I could have like
just your aura.
Out.
Yeah.
This is my farewell tour.
Well, just, you know, just stand back another 100 feet. I think that should clear the curse.
Okay, cool.
Oh, so no. I'm not doomed for the casino circuit? Oh, good.
Well, what I mean is that what reminds me of playtest experiences, because a lot of times you will see someone not get a thing you put a lot of effort into, and you'll instantly know why. And that will be a really good experience. So in the case of the chart, you learned really quickly like why this wasn't working, and you knew you had an idea for how to make that better in a future iteration.
Yeah.
But then there are other examples, and this also happens, where you see someone not getting it.
Yeah.
You just have no idea why.
Right.
And so I think that that is something that is whether there's a lot of that of the first type or the second type is kind of, at least in my experience, is not something you can plan for or and it's just a matter of like if you have enough data sets, if you do it enough times, you start to get a perspective on the fact that like there are some things that are out of your control.
Yeah.
All my instincts when I hear you describe this is me wanting to tell you that like there that you did nothing wrong at all. Like I don't want to be like just trying to like trying to make you feel better.
Except Mark, that was when it was done.
Yeah.
It was published. It was run.
Sure.
And it will never be run again.
Yeah. No, of course.
It is out there and it is finished and cannot be iterated on. It is playtesting live as a finished product.
Right. I'm just saying that experience, your scenario is such that you can't continue on with it.
Yeah.
And I think that might be what is changing how you feel about it.
Yeah. That's where the feels bad part of it comes from, because I can't do anything to learn for this project.
And that's true of all sorts of final projects. It's just that you won't always be so present when someone doesn't get a thing.
Sure.
They will either, as a player, will find a way around it, or it'll enter into a review or a bug report, but it won't be so like present to you because you're not experiencing it in what would otherwise be a playtest environment.
Would it be helpful if I described somewhat of a similar situation that I've had in the past? I don't know if it'll help you process emotions or not, but with Widget Satchel, actually, I think Widget Satchel went great. But to be clear, I feel like...
Disclaimer, went great, here are all the problems.
Right. in Widget Satchel, it's a platformer. I did a lot of the jump design, and I designed the jump to feel kind of like a dodge, because a lot of what you, because we did it during a game jam, and a lot of the initially, and a lot of the dodging you did, you jumped over robots, you jumped past them, so
and
they wouldn't
also,
hit you.
It's a little ferrety dude, right?
Yeah, and you play as a little ferret.
Those noodly little guys feel like they would dodge.
Exactly. So yeah. that was a lot of the inspiration for the design of the jump, is that like it's really fast. I think that a lot of people bristle up against that, and I hear that criticism a lot with Widget Satchel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Is that the jump feels bad. And it hasn't just been Widget Satchel. Like, other things that I've worked on in the past that have jumps that I've designed don't come across great. Mm-hmm.
You're just bad at jumps, is what you think?
Seems like you just want to wave dash everywhere.
Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. And so, like, I keep getting that feedback back over and over, and I've struggled to be able to understand what it is that doesn't work. Like, I've been able to look at Widget Satchel's jump, and like I recognize it's too fast, it's like near instant or whatever, and it's just too much. But like in other instances, I have a hard time being able to process what I like conceptually and even principally, like my principles are, but like, this is how a jump should be designed. Mm-hmm. And then I do it and it doesn't work and people don't like it, and I'm like, this is why is this wrong? I guess I haven't fully processed that either.
Yeah.
But I think that like I've come to terms with the idea that like it still needs work and I can still improve it. And like, even if I don't fully understand it, asking people for that feedback and taking what I've learned from past experiences into the future to help me make things better as best as I can has kind of helped me move forward with it. I don't know if that helps, Lydia, but
I mean, I think it's good that to hear that like the thing that is hard is still hard, but is being learned.
Yeah.
Where I feel the feels bad is, like, it is actively being a playtest that's not going well on a finished product that cannot be changed.
Yeah,
right.
It is also the things that I did really, really well last year, I didn't do this year, and I don't know why.
Sure.
And I only could see that in retrospect of, like, oh, these are the things that were really important, like, that were done really well and made it better, and I didn't do that, and I don't know why.
Yeah, okay.
And it's that kind of, like, it's those two things, I think, that really feel gross, and it's hard to, and so like there are some things like, hey, use recognizable phone numbers. You know,
they're solidified things that you know,
like,
are wrong.
But. Yes, kill your darlings. Hey, this was a darling. It got you excited. You loved it. It really was not the right time. Mm-hmm. But also like, or like the diagram, like, oh, now I know more about why this piece of content is difficult, and I now know how to use it better.
Right.
But it's the other stuff where it's like, I know that I've done this. I know that it's important, and I didn't do it this year, and I don't know why, because it wasn't a conscious decision.
Yeah.
And I think that then there's a little bit of distrust and the promise of the future of, like, I mean, there's obviously imposter syndrome, but like then there's also a little bit of a distrust where it's like, oh, the things that I did really well, they are not intuitive. And what does that mean for my future work?
I think this is, I think everyone goes through this on, it's a, I mean, it's like what, this, the cliche of the sophomore slump, right?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, this is obviously not the second thing you've made, but like the second thing in this series.
Yeah. Right?
So it has a little bit of that going on.
Yeah.
And I think with game design in particular, I think this might be, I would guess, a lot because it is part of this series.
Yeah.
So when you keep describing these things you did before and didn't do this time.
Yeah.
Kind of like it's a formula you can repeat, which is not untrue.
No.
To a degree. But I think that one of the things you learn when you make the second of something that's similar is how much starting over you have to do, and how surprising how surprising that you have to relearn things you thought you mastered.
Yeah,
Because in projects that are as complicated as games are, even simple ones, it's an entire universe you have to live in. Mm-hmm. And then when you make the next thing, you take all your skills with you, but you take very few of your concrete learnings.
Mm.
You have to learn a lot of that stuff again.
Mm. Yes.
Because you're in a different universe now.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel that really true. Like, sometimes I will go back to old work.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, why would, like, that's incredible. I had so much trouble doing it this time, and I wasn't thinking about the connection.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I see how easy it was, or remember how easy it was to do last time, I get really confused.
Yeah.
Because I don't see the reason why. And it's very similar to the description you're saying of, like, what is it about it that's different this time? Did you get lucky last time, or did you just forget something this time, or what changed about it?
Like, did I have some of it is like, because the idea of, like, not making excuses, like, did I have the space to have this come up in my brain.
Yeah.
And it, is the answer no? Was it just because of it or was it something else? I don't want to use just like the circumstances as a crutch.
Sure.
Because maybe there was, because I don't remember.
Well, I think, I would guess that, and I mean, this is true of everything. The more you do it, the better you are at managing this kind of thing.
Mm. Yeah.
So you'll probably be better at understanding the next time. Mm-hmm. Let's imagine you're doing one of these every year.
Yeah. Hopefully, fingers crossed that they'll have me for Phoenix, even if it's just to work on the project.
Yeah. I mean, you'll certainly be working on other things as well.
Yeah.
But just in the terms of this series of projects, you know a little bit more about the sort of like, if you're talking about universes, like the multiverse of possibilities, you know, the possibility space of how this stuff works. You understand it more maybe as a genre than you maybe did before because you have now your two examples.
Mm.
And so one went good and one went bad. The first one went good, the second one went bad. But like those, that is the arbitrary part.
Yeah.
Right? Mm. They are just two samples.
Yeah.
And both of those now contribute to your understanding of it as a project to do.
Mm.
So now you sort of know a little bit more on what to catch. Now that isn't going to mean that the third one is going to be somewhere in between or better than the first. It could go even worse.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be a result of many things. It could be a result of the conditions of that particular version of the project. It could be that there's so much more to learn about how to make it good that the first two experiences didn't give you.
Yeah.
Mm.
Right? In which case, you may find yourself even more frustrated if it doesn't go well.
Yeah.
But it could also be that like now you have a sort of wider understanding, these two data points. It's still just two data points,
mm-hmm.
but you probably have a lot more, I would guess anyway.
Yeah.
That when you do it again, you can keep on the lookout for those things that like, oh, this went really well. I'm just going to do the same thing again. Oh, wait. If I just do the same thing again, I won't consider because that, you know, and those mm-hmm. kinds of things. I'm speaking abstractly, but so, I mean, it's a simple lesson, but it's just,
mm-hmm.
it's still iteration, even though this version is done. You know, it's the next at bat. Like Steven, you're describing, you know, the next time you need to make a game with a jump, mm-hmm. you have all this understanding
mm-hmm.
of how people have reacted to the projects you've done with that. And so you're going to take that to it.
Yes.
Whether that produces a different result is a question answered by many factors.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you're definitely not going to go in it with ignorance.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was going to say, I think one of the things that I've been trying to work on in therapy is the idea that like some things are just things and you can't know why it happened.
Yeah.
And I mean, it sucks to hear because I'm like, this exists for a reason, right? Something I have to understand all the things that caused this to happen. But truthfully, it could just be that it just didn't.
Yeah.
You didn't think of it in the time. The situations were different. And I think that is something you have acknowledged.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's also something that like is true. Like I don't think that
it's unknowables.
I don't think that it's an excuse to say that this is a different situation and thus not just your mindset, but like the whole project became different as a result of that. But additionally, I think that just like there's so many things that are a factor in it that you're not necessarily going to find the one answer that answers that question for you.
Yeah.
So sorry.
Yeah. Do we have time for one more question?
Sure.
Oh, for sure.
So then how do you trust that there will be a next time when a project or something doesn't go well? Because I think like I you know try also just not to assume that someone likes my stuff or will want to invite me back on something because there's you know that's many reasons that I might not. I'm coming also from it in terms of like, my company was hired to make a thing. When it comes to like entertainment games, like, well, if we're making a sequel and if it's bad, that's really bad, right? And everyone kind of knows this idea of like sequelitis.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you also emotionally move forward and trust that there is the possibility of a next time so that way you can learn and use the things you learn and not and actually have a place to arrive without ignorance?
The short answer to that is you can't ensure it.
Right.
And certainly when you're a game designer and I'm in this position now where the next thing I'm working on is one of three things.
Yeah.
And is nothing like the things I worked on previously.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true for a lot of developers. You know, if you work at a place that makes fighting games, your next game is probably going to be a fighting game.
Mm-hmm.
Probably.
So maybe the size of the unknowable space is maybe a little smaller.
Yeah, yeah.
Not a ton smaller, but a little smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And you're in a situation now where you expect to be, or you would hope anyway, to work on a project that's similar to this a year from now.
Mm-hmm.
if there's a reason why, say, the client is either wants to move in another direction or is actually unhappy and wants to make a change, or whatever, or even internally, someone's like, Lydia, let's put you on something else, right? Like, there's many reasons why you wouldn't have that chance.
Yeah.
There are also many reasons why you would. I mean, if you're asking if you have like a risk of being taken off a project like this, I suspect that a lot of the people within your organization probably understand a lot about, about like, so, you know, some things are hits and some things are misses.
I think because like I know that I can't really control the all the tiny variables in the moment. I think like cosmically, if you'd make something bad, it feels very much like you've lost your shot to then have the opportunity to make something again have the chance to learn from your mistakes.
And that is sometimes true.
Yes.
I would wager that you probably don't have to worry about that. It's natural to worry about that in a specific situation.
Yeah.
I would probably, if it calms you down at all, I think you're probably worrying about it a little too much.
I mean, yeah, it's me.
Yeah, yeah. But as a general observation, you're absolutely right. Like, when something doesn't do as well, you're less likely to have another shot at it. That's true in all arenas. Now, the question is what is the next thing you make going to be? And that there's learnings and skills you might have to throw away because the next thing you're doing doesn't use those anymore and you have to build all new things.
Yeah.
I think maybe certainly as a working artist in many different fields, that's kind of an expected part of the gig, I guess, which isn't to say to don't worry about it. You shouldn't worry too much about the fact that the next thing you do is not going to be like the next Lego brick on top of the big sculpture that is your career.
Yeah.
Because that's just never how it works. The more you worry about like the efficiency loss of, I had this all the time when I was doing commercial video projects, is I would learn this incredible animation technique that saved us a bunch of time, really like wowed the client. And then the next client came in and they didn't want any of that.
Oh.
And then you're like, well, okay, I better not forget this for the next time someone wants it. But now I've got this new project. They hired us because of how successful the last one was.
Oh.
And now they want something similarly wow, but like they don't want the thing I made for them. So what, you know, that, so it's a thing that happens a lot with fields as varied as the ones we all work in.
Yeah.
And I think it's easy to mourn the lost efficiency, but it's unavoidable.
Yeah. I think about that with respect to like future club stuff. Like none of those things are going to see the light of day, probably. Yeah. And I mean, not Sledgehammer Bride. That's coming back.
That's coming. No.
Aside from that, a lot of the stuff that we worked on is just not going to see the light of day. And so, like a lot of the emotions behind that feels like, you know, I had a good rapport with a lot of the folks that I worked at Future Club, and we're not going to, I guess, like, I'm not going to have that again, but I can have something else that's new and different and exciting and special in a different way. That might even be better than what Future Club had for me. So just because you don't experience the same thing that you had before doesn't mean that you won't experience something that's worthwhile in the future.
It's also likely helpful to think of your goals going forward, not in terms of recapturing anything, things that have been lost. Because that can take a lot more energy, and usually you end up getting at best 90% of what you had.
Yeah.
When you could have used all that energy to just go for something else.
Yeah.
Again, that's really abstractly put, and maybe not applies in all situations, but I think it can be emotionally unconstructive to try to think of anything. I want to redo it. I want to wind back the clock and get back to where I was, or you know, this thing didn't work. Let's make sure that we can, let's try to make it so that as if it did go well in doing the next thing again, or taking your next project and trying to take all the lessons you learned from that to a project that those lessons wouldn't necessarily apply to.
Right.
That's a very natural instinct, I think. And it takes a lot of kind of some discipline and a little bit of like, maybe there's like some like relaxation to it, where you kind of just have to be really comfortable with the world of your knowledge and skills just has to be larger. And it has to have lots of unrevisited corners, you know? And that should be something maybe you can get excited about, actually.
Yeah. Man, I do hope I can work on another escape room someday.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely can.
If nothing else, I think it's well proven to every stakeholder and that it is a thing you can do.
Yes.
Not just because it went so great last year, but because you made a second one at all.
You're right.
Oh.
True.
I think we also undervalue our capacities to make a thing at all.
Yeah.
Because,
I mean, and this is true for listeners out there who put out a game that, you know, didn't get a lot of reviews on Steam and mm-hmm. just disappeared into the ether. Like, you've beaten 90%
yes.
of your
yeah,
peers.
Things right. are hard.
Right.
And also, you have proven your skill by producing something.
Yeah.
And not to say that you shouldn't, that it's like everything is a hidden gem or something. Mm-hmm. Maybe the thing you made was bad. But, like, the incredible amount of talent and ability it takes for you to get at least even that far.
Right.
And to people who might either hire you or work with you or purchase things from you, they may not understand that, but like they are looking for what you have.
Yes.
And so there is no reason for you to think that it may be a step back in a career sense and everyone's situation is different. Mm-hmm. Consequences are different in every scenario. Mm-hmm. Sometimes just this didn't work right to the next one or
yeah.
this didn't work. Now I'm unemployed, or this didn't work and now I have to do something else to make money for a year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like all of those things, a big range of possibilities. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it should comfort you to know in any of the situations that even putting out something that sucks or doesn't meet your expectations, to be less blunt about it, is a demonstration of your ability.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It may also demonstrate mistakes and how far you have to go and that you bit off more than you can chew. It demonstrates other things. But one thing it does demonstrate is that you can do this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I would like to think well enough of the people in whatever industry you're in, that the people you work with, is that they know that,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's to you specifically, Lydia, but I think that's to everybody listening who's had a similar experience
yeah.
of a setback or a follow-up that didn't pan out
yeah.
or something like that.
Yeah. Me. Did that
think
help?
So. Yeah, I think so. Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Right, so I've been looking at the Nice Games Club wallet. It's looking a little
looking bit. Deep into that void.
oh wait, there's a moth. I saw it. Bye.
Yeah, yeah.
Don't eat my yarn.
We can't even afford better cliches, people.
And soon I'm not going to have any yarn left because that moth has left the wallet.
Oh, no. Well, we better get some more money. Where can we get that? Maybe listeners, you can go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub and give us some.
Yeah, you can become a patron.
Yep.
For any amount you want. There's different tiers, to very low to not as low. So it's a fairly cheap expense.
Mm-hmm.
What you get is you get ad-free episodes. You get a special RSS feed that'll give you that. They also come to you a week early, which is kind of nice.
Yeah.
A new thing we started this year, we think is working out pretty well.
Yes.
But on top of that, there's some bonus content.
Yeah.
Some extra stuff from our anniversary episodes. We got some animal pictures.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Some fun stuff. But the main thing that you get is the knowledge that you're supporting the program
yeah.
and helping it continue on. We have the show costs. It's not a high budget operation.
Right.
Nope.
It does need some money to keep going.
Yeah.
And this is a labor of love for all of us.
Yeah.
We're not making a lot of money, even if you give us some. But if you can give us some, it could be more sustainable operation.
Yeah, yeah, we can deal with this moth bothering yeah. us right
we
now.
We can have new
a fly swatter.
Earphone covers.
Yeah. Things like that, for instance. Yeah. So if you go to patreon.com/nicegamesclub, we'd really appreciate your help.
All right, Steven, so when you were talking about the planning the episode for today,
uh-huh.
you were saying that
this
you like
going to be Marcus Wright thing, isn't it?
No.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah, because you're starting with that cadence. You're coming in for landing, dude.
I always sound that way.
Okay.
That is true. That is actually fair.
Draw whatever conclusion from that you may. You were talking about how you organized the show. So Steven is in charge of picking which topic in our roundtables go first. And he likes to structure it so that the topic he thinks is going to take most of the episode goes first.
Yes.
So that we can give it all the time it needs.
Yeah.
And then he likes to stick the second topic as things we can cut off at the knees.
Uh-huh.
Now, here's the thing. We're an hour into the program already.
Oh, God. I'm so sorry.
No, this was important.
No. And it doesn't actually, it doesn't happen that often.
Yeah.
Right? It happens way less often than I'd expected.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we don't keep a stopwatch here at the program. Mm-hmm. We just sort of have a habit of this. So the question is, Steven, is how quickly can you get us through your topic, the critical eye?
Okay, well, we'll probably have to talk about this longer at a later date, but that's fine.
Yeah.
Technically, what I wanted to talk about is months ago, a year ago, I don't know, remember when I was working on a movie and I was like, oh man, I'm going to look at movies completely differently?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I did, and I was annoyed about it.
I was so excited and you were so bummed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I...
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I'm at the point now where I've accepted that, like, I'm looking at movies differently, and that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so I've been thinking about it and with respect to, like, games. Because, like, I've always looked at games differently ever since I've developed them. But that never really affected things. That actually did enhance my gameplay experience.
Oh, interesting.
But I think largely because I realized that like games were not just code and art, it was also design, and I didn't even realize that was a thing when I first started thinking about this.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I've been thinking about the idea of looking at games critically and being able to recognize that what is working in a game, even if it isn't working for you specifically,
mm-hmm.
I think that is skill is important, and being able to use that information to grab things that you like and make sense from other games and put that in your own work.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess I just want to talk about that. We could talk about that briefly.
Yeah.
I think that like specifically, I wanted to talk about like analyzing what works in a game and being able to separate your opinions on what work for games, or not your opinions on what work for a game, but your opinions on what you like about games.
Right.
Versus recognizing that this works for it. So, mm-hmm. like, for instance, I always bring up, well, this is a little bit biased. I'm a little biased about it because, like, I like the way that Breath of the Wild has breakable weapons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that game doesn't work without it.
I agree.
Yeah. But I do recognize that, like, maybe the way that it is implemented isn't perfect.
Right. Well, could there be a way to do that mechanically in a way that didn't annoy so many players?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because you get that feedback enough to know that, like, there's something wrong with it, even if it's necessary.
Yeah.
So, like, those kinds of things.
And is that annoyance maybe, is it something that, like, is actually deliberate? Is it part of the intention of the game?
Yeah.
To frustrate the player?
Right.
And that's something that we don't necessarily know.
Yeah, yeah.
But as a sort of a, that's the critical eye of that, is like thinking of how much of that is just a consequence of choices versus a deliberate intent.
Yeah,
or,
yeah.
Right? Yeah, or is it meant to reinforce something thematically, like a sense of decay?
Right, right. Sometimes the frustration, we talked about this before, sometimes there's friction that is involved in the game that it helps enhance the experience, but is opposing what the player would want from that experience.
Yeah.
Well, not want from that experience, but want from the play.
Yeah, games that serve, that give the player everything they want are...
That's just a sandbox.
Yeah, those are not good games.
Yeah.
Like,
Tears of the Kingdom.
well, I wouldn't go that far, but...
Okay, fair.
But I think as a developer, you have an instinct to like create a very good piece of software that provides all the user, the affordances the user wants, and gives them as little friction as possible.
Yes.
And then suddenly you realize that you're just making a button presser.
Yeah.
You know, you're not making whatever genre you're making, you're not actually like providing any of the value that an interactive piece of media can give you.
Yeah. You're not providing the experience that you wanted, the player is expecting.
And that isn't always mechanically. Sometimes it's also narratively.
Like, it is.
So like, well, you know, you want to tell the story in a way that is easy for the player to understand, mm-hmm. well, then are you telling an interesting enough story?
Yeah. Like, sometimes people put jump scares in games that have no business having jump scares,
mm-hmm.
and that bothers me explicitly.
Yeah.
So stop doing it. but like those kinds of things impact a player's experience in a negative way that you want to be able to look out for. And I think that like as developers, we want to be able to acknowledge when something is working and isn't working in a game. But like, it's important to make sure that like, for instance, I don't like horror things.
Mm-hmm.
It's important for me to acknowledge that just because this thing is scary does not mean that it doesn't work for this game.
Yeah.
It just means I don't like it. But it could be an important and valuable aspect of that experience that makes it better.
You know, I really love watching people play horror games because mm-hmm. my fear responses are exactly the ones that would not let me play horror games effectively, because then I wouldn't play the game.
Yeah.
That is where I think I've started getting that critical eye, because I was watching something that I could not play.
Yeah.
And then when I extended to, you know, being curious about other video games and started watching games that I would not play for whatever reason, if just didn't like it, that was where I could then say, oh, I see what they're doing here.
Yeah.
Oh, I understand why this works, or I can see why they're doing this, even if it's something that I don't personally like.
Yeah.
And I think kind of in that sense of removing yourself from the like v dislike to see the mechanisms, then kind of gives you a reference. So that way, when you are playing something that you like, you are able to kind of fine tune that and separate the two a little bit.
Exactly. That is an important thing. And I want to make a distinction between like a critic's perspective and the critical eye.
Yes.
Because like a critic is judging it and like is saying what went right and wrong. But for the perspective of like, I guess, informing other people of that information, whereas like for us as developers, we want to look at that stuff and practice understanding how games work.
Yeah, like oh, this was a clever thing. Oh, I see why they made this decision.
Yeah.
Oh, I think that they did it this way because of insert here.
Yeah, yeah. And so, like, I think it's also important when you're looking at it from a critical eye to recognize the processes that go into making a game.
Yeah.
As you're playing it, you can do that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so, like, you know, you could think about, like, how they decided to do the post-processing or something.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You can kind of analyze and be like, this isn't how I would do it. You can't do all of it unless you, like, literally go into the code. But, like,
yeah,
you could also literally go into the code sometimes.
Right. And, you know, you don't have to be a developer to have this eye.
Yes.
Of course, we as developers and our audience are mostly developers, I suspect. Mm-hmm. Will probably have this perspective, but like the more you understand about how things are made, mm-hmm. the more you can actually extract what the intention of the developer is.
Yeah.
This is true of movies too, right?
Yes.
Like, you know, I don't know a lot of people who have like helmed a feature film, but I know most people have seen behind the scenes content and listened to director's commentary. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That gives you a lot of understanding of like why things are made the way they are. Whereas if you didn't have that kind of understanding, you could watch a movie and start getting messages that weren't intended,
right,
because of things that are consequences of production.
Yes.
And that's true in games as well. And that might be a little pessimistic about like the capacity of this media to be all intention and no production.
Sure.
Like seems, but like it is a thing that happens.
Yeah, yeah, right? Yeah.
I think also even if it starts to refine your palate, because I think of it in terms of cooking, mm-hmm. where like you can taste something and go, this needs something and I don't know what it is, but yeah. I can tell it needs it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can say like, it needs something bright.
Yeah.
And you don't know what that means, but you know that that's what it needs. Mm-hmm. You can also, as you kind of train that eye, you can start seeing in your own work or in other people's works, like what is not quite working? What is something missing? And, you know, you aren't going to always have the answers, but that the fact that you recognize that there is something, a component that can be added, fixed, removed, rectified, that would then change the experience is itself a great knowledge, a sense of like, you seeing into the mechanics.
Yeah, that's why I wanted to bring it up. And the way that I brought it up is because I started making movies, I am now recognizing the different ways that shown in video games or in media,
right.
Other media.
You're getting a cross-disciplinary understanding.
Yeah.
And I can bring that into my work, into my video game development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that has been valuable. You're right, Mark. Thank you.
See, I didn't have to say it. It came to me naturally.
Uh-huh. No, I just wanted to give that to you. Did I do it? That was pretty sharp.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it ended really great, I think.
So. Okay. That's good. That's good.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes delivered to you 1 week early. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Discuss this episode or others or whatever with your fellow listeners on Discord. Stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.